animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animal, talking animal.
Good morning, this is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. It's April Fool's Day, so please insert your own joke here. Before I go any further, I want to thank Bev Capshaw for sitting in for me last week, delivering a slew of terrific animal songs. And speaking of being helped by good friends, as you probably know, in the wake of the Safer at Home order that Hillsborough County issued at the end of last week, most programmers are prevented from coming to WMNF to produce our shows directly. So I'm presenting today's edition of Talking Animals remotely from my house in Jupiter Farms with the considerable help of my friend and yours, the fabulous Flea. Thank you, Flea. How are you? How's it going today, Flea?
It's going great, Duncan. How are you?
Good, and I think we have super impressive social distancing, like 200 miles.
Excellent. We'll just squeeze a few more people in between us.
Okay, I think so. All right, so with Flea's in-studio assistance, I'm aiming to deliver a version of Talking Animals that I hope closely resembles a regular edition. So that will include playing back two interviews I recorded in recent days. The first, which we'll hear in just a moment, is with Jerry Bishop, the co-founder and director of training at F1 Canine, a Florida firm that trains and provides dogs for various purposes, including the detection of drugs and agricultural disease. The core of this conversation with Bishop will involve their pioneering work in tandem with a USDA government study to train dogs to detect HLB, a bacterium that keeps fruit from ripening. Since it started surfacing about 15 years ago, HLB has caused a 75% decline in Florida's $9 billion citrus industry. As you'll hear, these dogs can detect HLB much, much faster and more accurately than any other method. Once again, we'll see how amazing dogs can be. And this specialized training has implications for what's left of the Florida citrus industry, as well as in California, Texas, and actually in several other countries. Bishop and those F1 canine dogs are the only ones capable of doing this work, and it's a pretty interesting story, as is Bishop's about how he got into working with dogs in the first place. So we'll hear that interview in just a moment here on Talking Animals on WMNF. Later in the show, I'll air another shorter interview I recorded with Talking Animals' longtime Greyhound correspondent Don Goldstein, addressing how the coronavirus has closed down the Florida dog racing track, as it has so many businesses, obviously, in a way that's starting to brush up against the deadline for shutting down the tracks permanently under the dictates of Amendment 13, and what all that means for the dog adoption of dogs and more. Right now, though, let's play back the interview with Jerry Bishop about dogs that can detect that citrus disease. This is Jerry Bishop on Talking Animals on WMNF.
Well, let's welcome to Talking Animals Jerry Bishop. Thanks for joining us on Talking Animals, Jerry.
You're very welcome, Duncan.
So before we get into discussing F1 canine and what all the dogs there can do, let's talk a bit about your background. When did you first get into working with dogs?
About 20 years ago.
What first got you into it? What was your first step in that regard?
My wife used to work for Southeast Narcotics Task Force, and she used to work for the canine handler for Southeast Narcotics Task Force. And then we moved, and we found some property, and actually we moved not too far from him. So he was doing explosive work, contract work for Carnival Cruise Line. And he asked me if I would like to get into the business of handling dogs for explosives.
Wow, can I interrupt you right there? Because well, right off the bat, I'm fascinated to know what Carnival Cruise Lines, what their particular focus was in terms of explosives and dogs.
What we did was check all the provisions that went on board.
I see.
Yes.
And because there were specific threats or just as an overall precaution or what?
It was a precaution.
Oh, it's interesting.
Yes.
Yeah.
So. Yes. So every cruise ship gets inspected with canines, all the provisions that go on board.
So you're saying that's industry-wide, not just Carnival?
That's industry-wide.
Wow, that's interesting. All right, so we've already learned something totally significant before we got into the focus of our conversation, so that's pretty good. Anyway, sorry to interrupt you, but go back to your story. So he asked you if you wanted to get involved, and I guess that's where we left off.
Yes, he wanted me to get involved because he was having problems of doing part of the contract at the Canaveral Seashore, not Canaveral, but the Port Canaveral. And so I just decided I would take him up on his offer. And then I started learning how to handle dogs and started learning how to train dogs.
So, Jerry, were you a dog guy growing up, just like had dogs in the family? I mean, it sounds like you kind of started from scratch. Just with his inquiry about whether you'd be interested in getting involved, that seems kind of interesting, unless you already had a demonstrated ability and or affection or something for dogs. That seems kind of interesting that he would single you out, for example.
Well, we had pets and things like that, but never anything like this.
Yeah, okay. So he just saw something in you and said, hey, I bet this guy could do this.
Yes. So what it was, is he also trained and sold dogs to military and police departments.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yes. And so he needed some help, and he asked me if I wanted to do it. And I've been doing, I was doing construction. I'm a union pipe fitter. And I was just a little, you know, I needed a change. So
it came at the right time.
And yes, it did.
Yeah. So that was focused really on training dogs to detect explosives, I guess, at the very beginning.
Yes, explosives, narcotic, all different. We train cell phone dogs, gun dogs, currency dogs for custom. So we've done the gamut of training.
We'll maybe come back to this later when we're talking about dogs specifically trying to detect HLB. Is it all kind of the same principle if a dog's being trained to detect a weapon or a drug or a cell phone or an explosive? I mean, some of those things obviously seem kind of different from each other. So is it fundamentally the same and then it branches into a more specific kind of training? How does that work?
It's all fundamentally the same. The only thing is different is that if you do a gun dog, it's just one odor or currency.
Okay.
But if you do an explosive dog, you have 16 different explosives.
Oh, I see. So then that dog then has to have, I would say, I guess, more specialized training because they have to recognize any one of those 15 odors, whereas if it's trying to find a cell phone or whatever it might be, it's like there's one odor, so it's either the cell phone's there or it's not there.
Yes. So that's the only difference.
Yeah, but it sounds like for things like things that do have multiple odors, the training would have to be more extensive or detailed or maybe just a longer period of training.
Exactly.
Yeah. So once you got into this, then what sort of protocol, because it sounds like you had dogs in the family and you grew up with animals. Is there a certain protocol for dogs that are being trained to do this? Like, I mean, some of them, it seems like from what we've seen and learned over the years, live with their handlers, if it's sort of especially if it's more of a one-on-one thing. But if it's multiple dogs, do some live with you or other handlers and some live elsewhere? How does that work?
So we have a multiple dog, but we don't have enough handlers for them to go home. So they actually stay in a kennel, and they get out every day. We train with them every day. We play with them every day.
Yeah.
So it's not like a police department where the handler and the dog, they go home together. And so I wish I had plenty of handlers, but we have so many dogs to do this project that it's not feasible.
Right. How many dogs currently are there and how many handlers?
Right now we have 20 dogs and we have like four or five handlers.
I see. Yeah. So it's not even close to getting to be like a one-on-one kind of thing. I guess you probably couldn't take multiple dogs home if they were these kind of dogs. Is that?
Yeah. These dogs are very high drive.
So they would sort of expect and maybe even demand that handler's full attention if they were at home. And if there's three or four of them there, there would just be no way to make that work. Is that what you're saying? It sounds tricky. So it sounds like they got to live elsewhere, but it sounds like every day, is it a pretty much of a full day of training and play and stuff with these dogs?
It's a full day. It definitely is, except for on the weekend, but then the kennel hands will get them out and let them run around.
Yeah. All right, so this is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss, and my guest is Jerry Bishop, Director of Training at F1 K9, a Florida firm that trains and provides dogs for various purposes, including the detection of drugs and agricultural disease. This conversation was recorded Saturday. So you started off, that guy said, hey, this Jerry seems like he might be good at training the dogs, working with the dogs. So how many years did you do that before something else, you branched off or got involved with a different or side of the profession, I should say, or a different organization?
Well, I did that for probably about 17 years.
Oh, wow.
I worked for him.
Yeah, okay.
Yes. And then I retired, and then the government came to Billy and I, and which is my partner, and asked us if we wanted to finish up this HLB grant. Was already started by the other company, which I started with the other company.
I see. And then when you retired, I guess that left that company without probably a pivotal person to carry out the grant. Is that kind of how this came to be, where they sought you out?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly, because I actually started the training of all the HLB dogs and the PPP dogs. So that's the reason that the government came to me.
So I guess now, even though we're going to get into it maybe at some point, since we're referring to HLB, I guess we should really talk about that. But before we do, let me ask you this. First of all, so the current company is F1 Canine. So that's the one that after you had retired and then you were approached by the government to carry out this grant that we'll talk about in more detail in a moment. That's the entity that you and one or two others formed.
Yes.
Okay, so that's F1 Canine. And was that expressly for the purpose then of carrying out the grant and the research that went with that?
Yes, it was. It was strictly for that. It was to finish up the HLB grant to see if we could actually commercialize this and see where this was going to go.
Are there any other companies? It sounds like not, based on what you just said about being approached after you retired. Are there any other companies in Florida or elsewhere, for that matter, that do this kind of work, or is it so specialized that it's pretty much just F1 Canine?
It's just F1 Canine. We're the only ones, and right now, that I know of in the world that are doing this.
Now, are there others that detect agricultural disease but not HLB? Are there some that do some of that but not the specific HLB work?
I've heard that there is, but I couldn't tell you what they're doing.
I see. Okay. So there might be some others out there doing some kind of agricultural detection work, but they're obviously not prominent players if you're not fully aware of who they are or what their names are. Or,
yes.
Yeah, I got it. So it's probably a bit of a cryptic reference so far for our audience to keep saying HLB. Let's talk a little bit more about that. Well, you and I met when I was writing a story about dogs who are deployed to detect HLB. Can you, in Citrus Grove, can you describe what HLB is and the impact that it's had on Florida's citrus industry?
Well, HLB is it's an Asian disease. It's called greening. It's got a very long name.
Yeah.
Which is very hard to pronounce. But
that's why we like HLB. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, exactly. Or yeah. Greening.
Right, okay.
But it's impacted the Florida industry to about 75% of it. It is destroying the citrus crop here in Florida. And it's just not oranges. It's lemons, it's limes, it's tangerines, grapefruit, and there's no cure for it.
So once a crop gets HLB, it's done.
It's done.
Yeah. And so, yeah, you're saying 75% of the industry has been devastated by it already. I guess it's spread by this really small flying insect, right? The psyllid?
It's a psyllid.
Psyllid, that's right. Yeah, I wasn't sure. I should know how to pronounce it by now, but I didn't. But anyway, so, and Dr. Gottwald, who's kind of a pivotal player in the story, we'll probably come back to him as well, who's with the USDA, described it to me as a little flying hypodermic needle. So basically this psyllid goes from plant to plant and takes, I guess, some nectar or juice out of a plant, but in doing so has the HLB in that same kind of needle, the little needle of its nose, and so it's depositing that in the plants as it sort of goes from plant to plant, as my understanding.
Yes.
Yeah.
What happens is that you take a psyllid that is a negative psyllid that doesn't have HLB, and it goes eats on a positive plant, that psyllid becomes positive. So he'll fly over to a negative plant, and the psyllid's positive, he'll eat on that plant, and he'll make that plant positive.
And so the thing is, this has been happening, and I guess it probably was first detected some, I guess the better part of 15 years ago, right? That the first signs of this kind of surface?
Yeah, it's been going on for 15 or 20 years.
Yeah.
And it's just not in Florida. It's in Brazil, South Africa, Indonesia, Argentina. It's a lot of places.
And has it had similar impact, Jerry, in those other countries as to what Florida, for example, has experienced?
Yes, it has.
So the point is, when there's HLB and a psyllid, it's devastating. It's just a matter of time before the scope of that devastation, I guess, is realized.
Exactly.
So here's what we've got. We've got this disease that's spread by this flying insect. And again, already over those years, 75% devastation of the citrus industry, which again, is I think was like a $9 billion industry. So we're talking, I mean, people think of Florida, they think of citrus, but they may or may not be aware of just the financial impact, especially when it's been cut by some 75%. So I guess this is now the time to come back to the dog. From your standpoint, what sort of difference to this kind of pretty awful scenario in Florida, we're really talking about devastating the whole industry, have the dogs made? For example, how do the dogs stack up in detecting HLB compared with other methods for detecting HLB?
They're a pretty early detection device. They have found this. Now, this has only been in trials right now, but they have found it within 2 to 3 weeks when the plant was infected, and it didn't test positive for almost a year and 3 months.
Oh, wow. So, okay, that's even better than I guess I had understood. So if I follow what you're saying, so a dog could go out, or dogs could go out into a grove, and there could be citrus trees there that are not HLB positive, but the dogs can recognize that they're on the path to becoming HLB positive?
They're actually, when the dog sits on the plant, it is HLB positive.
Okay.
They won't be able to detect it for a while. It all depends how long it's also been there. And their PCR testing is very flawed.
Yeah, well, I guess I should say that maybe we should talk for a moment about the other methods, because that the difference with the dogs is so dramatic. So there's, I guess, visual inspection, which, as I understand it, I mean, if you can observe that there are signs of HLB on citrus crops, it's way, way too late to do anything, because as you mentioned earlier, there's no cure for this. So if you say, hey, those trees have HLB, again, you're out of business with those trees, that you're done.
Yes. Even if you don't see it and it still comes up positive, it's still going to devastate the grove.
Right. But the visual inspection, I guess, it seems like that's super slow and ineffective, because by the time, just if you're just working visually, that you say, well, there's HLB there, there's nothing anybody can do. And whereas I guess this PCR, this sort of lab procedure, is better, I guess, than visual, if I understand it correctly, but only analyzes tissue from a given tree. So if you take something from this tree here and two trees over, or even the same tree, I guess, arguably, might have different tissue in it, so the results may or may not be conclusive.
It's true. What the biggest problem is with the PCR testing is the gathering of the leaves, because you have such a big tree, and so they pick in quadrant around the tree, and then they'll take these leaves and then they'll test them. And if you don't pick the right lead, it will come up negative.
Right, which may or may not be accurate.
Exactly.
Yeah.
If you talk to Gottwall, he'll tell you different things that we are a little bit of trade secrets there. But it's basically the same thing. They get rewarded. They love their toy. But it's basically like we train a drug or explosive dog.
So it's just a procedure of exposing, let's just set aside HLB for a sec, but whatever it is, they're just exposed to it like gradually in ways that they're sort of asked to learn this is the item that they're supposed to be seeking or detecting, and they're just sort of like drills or
yeah, exactly. Everything is very, you have to be very consistent. You have to, on training.
Yeah.
Everything is consistent. You have to do the same thing all the time. You can't change it too much. What I base this when we're training our these HLB dogs, let's say, I mean, you take a drug dog and it's trained on marijuana, cocaine, crack cocaine, heroin, speed, or meth. When I train a dog on HLB, I tell people that it's like this. These plants, the orange trees or lemon trees, they all smell the same. There's something different in the HLB tree. I mean, in the positive tree. If I pull a leaf off of each tree and I smell the leaf and break it, they smell like citrus. I can't tell the difference. So I tell people, you take cocaine, which has cut in it, you know, which is, you know, not impure, and you take crack cocaine, which is pure, and you're telling the dog, because they both smell the same, but you're telling the dog, I don't want you to sit on the crack cocaine because it's pure, but I want you to sit on the other cocaine, which it has a bunch of cut in it, you know, and it's mixed. So you're telling them, but it smells the same. You don't want them to sit on this one, but you want them to sit on this one.
So, again, given that I have a show called Talking Animals, I totally appreciate the value of having a conversation with the dog about which cocaine to sit on and point out. But is it just by repeating training measures that to actually carry out what you describe? Because if you're saying, okay, here, I don't want you to sit on crack cocaine, meaning I don't want you to alert that there's cocaine there if it's crack cocaine. I only want you to alert if it's cocaine that's cut with whatever it might be with.
Yes, exactly. It's the same thing. I don't want you to sit on the negative plant. I want you to sit on the positive plant.
Yeah, but it sounds so specialized, and maybe it's the same in HLB things, because if you're saying, again, well, to many of us, whether you're a dog or not, if it's cocaine or a crack cocaine, you'd think it's, obviously there's going to be some differences, but you're saying, I don't want that, I don't want you to alert me to that, because that's not what we're looking for. So it just seems like plants or trees, it would seem like so infinitesimal, the difference, although again, I'm not the dog, so I can't smell or describe what that difference is, but it just seems like, it's just amazing to me that they can, I guess, just over time start to recognize what the HLB thing is that they're being trained to detect, and then it's fast, right? I mean, I was out in some groves, and it's like within 2 or 3 seconds, they pass by a tree, and they keep going by many of them, and then all of a sudden they plop right down. It's like, well, that's obviously a HLB tree.
Exactly. Because, like I said, what I was talking about before with the cocaine, training a drug dog, the drug dog will sit on, it doesn't matter if it's crack or regular cocaine, it will sit on it.
Yeah.
But like I said, with the plant, it's just a minute, something different, something in that plant that's making the dog sit. And Gottwall and all the experiments that we've been doing with these dogs, they're starting to think that they're actually sitting on the disease itself.
Sitting on the what, sorry?
The disease itself.
Okay. So that makes me wonder, like, are some dogs good at detecting, let's say, drugs or weapons or phones or whatever it might be, but maybe not so good at detecting HLB, and vice versa? Are some dogs just particularly adept at detecting HLB?
Well, these dogs that I trained for HLB or any agriculture disease, they could have been bomb dogs or explosive dogs. I mean, explosive or drug dogs.
Okay.
Yes.
So it's this, again, because like we talked about earlier in the conversation, the idea is that there's general training that's consistent no matter what that dog's going to ultimately be focused on detecting, and then it sort of branches off, if I follow you, into, okay, this over here we're going to be detecting weapons, over here we're going to be detecting explosives, and over here okay. So basically, like some of the dogs that I met out there on that day in that grove in Perry, if need be, if an assignment came up the next day or 2 days later, if there was something that required them to detect explosives somewhere, or go scan a cruise ship, let's say, or whatever, when the provisions came in, could they do that? Or once they go down the path to be HLB dogs, is that kind of then remain their specialty?
That remains their specialty.
Okay, so they wouldn't then be directed to do some other assignment?
No.
Okay, so that's so interesting. So if I'm not mistaken, correct me if I'm wrong here on this, Jerry, but I believe it's only been about a year, maybe a year and a half, that the dogs have been sent on professional runs for HLB detection, meaning not training or practice runs, but actually jobs that they're where they were detecting out on groves where people thought they might have HLB or were concerned that they did or maybe knew that they did. Is that right, that it's relatively a short period of time since this has been a professional undertaking?
Yes, it has. And we've been doing most of our work. We've been doing some up in North Florida, but we've been doing a lot out in California.
And how does the California situation in terms of the industry stack up alongside what's happened in Florida?
They're still doing pretty good out there, but they have the disease, but they're not, if they don't do anything about it, they're going to start looking like Florida. And Texas is already almost getting like Florida.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah.
But once word got out that the government alongside F1 Canine had these dogs that had this ability, weren't people in different states saying, geez, get those dogs out here, man. Let's see if we can slow this down. Maybe it sounds like we can't stop it, but maybe we can slow the spread. Weren't people sort of pretty eager to get you guys wherever there was instances of HLB once they knew that you were getting these kind of results?
No.
Oh, really?
They were very skeptic about the dogs.
Oh, so they thought it was kind of like baloney that these results were presented as what they were doing?
Yes. When I first went out to California with these dogs, and they were sitting quite a bit on the trees and in California, they were like, oh, they're doing that on purpose. They're trying to scare us.
Oh, wow.
Oh, yes. It was not pretty.
But here's the thing about that is that the people you gave in that example, if they said, okay, I don't believe it, they're just sitting now on a bunch of trees that don't have HLB, but wouldn't there be sometime shortly thereafter or at a certain period thereafter where those trees that those dogs sat at as being identified as having HLB, wouldn't those later have been proven to have HLB?
That has happened, but it took a while. It took almost 2 to 3 years to some of the trees to pop positive.
Oh, wow. So I guess the skeptics probably, are they still skeptical now, or are they sort of thinking, okay, well, I didn't believe it at first, and it took a while for me to see what the results were, but now I'm a believer?
There are people that are coming around to it right now.
Yeah.
It's taken a little while.
Yeah.
But I got some growers in Ventura that do believe in the dogs, and we have been doing some work out there for them, and we're supposed to be, actually, if it wasn't for COVID-19, we were supposed to be out in California right now with 8 dogs and 2 handlers already set up and doing work.
In Ventura County?
Yeah, in Ventura County.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting because to me, I guess if I were a citrus grower, maybe I would be naturally skeptical. But the problem, it seems like, as we've already established, is this HLB is so vicious, and the last thing you do is have time. If there's a possibility, or even a much less a probability, that a certain grove is going to be infected, the last thing you want to do is sit back and say, well, I don't really believe this dog thing, and let's just see what happens. And then it seems like inevitably almost, those groves would become infected with HLB.
Yes.
Wow.
We did a grove out there not too long ago, about 3 months ago. And then what they did is they didn't pull the plants on one of these rows that we were in the groves. So when we came back out, they wanted us to run the same plant. And we ran them with a different dog that hadn't been out in California. And my dog sat on the same plant that the other dog sat on about a month earlier.
Wow.
And didn't sit on any other plant. So that really showed them that, hey, these dogs are right. They know what they're doing. Because what we had, when we went to California and we set up a bunch of the growers, and they promised that whatever trees that the dogs sat on, that they were going to pull.
Yeah.
So they're starting to come around.
Yeah. Well, I guess it's just, you know, it's natural, I guess, for an industry almost of any kind to move slowly, especially when there's so much economic at stake. But the irony here is that the economic, if they embrace the dog sooner, probably could have been greatly enhanced for them. But, you know, people can only do what they can do. And if they just were that skeptical, I guess they had to be further convinced. But it sounds like at least in Ventura and elsewhere, they are being convinced.
Yes, they are, because they, you know, and which I don't blame them. They're thinking, oh, we just want to go out there and make money. And we're just making our dogs sit on the trees. But it's not. We're out there trying to help them.
Yeah.
And we're not like that. I mean, these dogs, when they sit, it's positive.
Yeah, and it is a pretty remarkable thing to behold, because you and the other handlers, at least in the outing that I saw, I mean, you guys are like really almost sprinting down aisles, rows of trees, but those dogs, I mean, they'll just drop at a second under a tree, and I mean, there's no question, like, you know, hey, which tree did they mean? I mean, they sit right under it, and but otherwise they're going fast. So again, they're detecting this and 2, 3, 4 seconds or so, it appears. So once you are a believer, then it seems like these dogs could really help if you're a citrus grower, wherever you are, save yourself some significant losses because you could get onto it early, and you pulled those trees early, then the disease hopefully wouldn't spread, then you'd be considerably ahead of the game.
Yes, definitely be ahead of the game. And people didn't believe what was going on because the paper hasn't come out for all the experimental things that Gottwald was doing with the dogs.
Yeah.
And his paper came out in PNAS, so...
That's a prestigious journal of some kind. I'm not sure what that stands for, but I...
It's a very prestigious journal,
yeah.
And his paper came out, and news outlets and picked up on it, and it went viral very quick.
I'm sure. Well, that's got to totally, I think, change the perception and certainly knock down, I would think, at least most, if not all, of the skepticism, because when you've got a prestigious journal and there's a scientific sort of research presented by a very also prominent USDA researcher, it'd be hard to sort of not take that totally seriously at that point. I mean, that's...
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, Jerry, we're just about at the end of our time. So, yeah, you kind of mentioned that the COVID-19 has already at least postponed a trip. Has it had, I mean, it's obviously the issue of the moment. It seems to be affecting everything. Has the coronavirus done other things to affect the operation or training or anything else? Or are you still doing everything else that you would be doing? It's just you can't really travel to, let's say, California or jobs right now.
Yeah, we're doing everything. We're still getting the dogs out. We're still training with them. We're still playing with them every day because it's just a few of us.
Yeah,
and we're not around a lot of people, and it's just a dog. So
yeah,
we're still doing the same thing. The only thing we're not doing is doing any traveling.
Right. So until those restrictions are lifted, you can't really go out on any jobs. But at least once those restrictions are, which hopefully won't be too far down the road, then the dogs will be still ready and raring to go and fully geared up, trained, exercised, and eager. So cool. Well, Jerry, thank you so much. We've been speaking again with Jerry Bishop. The company name is F1 Canine. The website is F1-Canine.com if you want to find out more about the dogs and Jerry and just how things work. And, Jerry, thank you so much for making the time to join us today on Talking Animals and filling us in on these pretty amazing dogs.
You're welcome, Duncan. Anytime.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
My thanks again to Jerry Bishop. And, boy, you should see those dogs in action. They move fast. Speaking of which, in a moment, I'll play back my conversation with Don Goldstein, our longtime Greyhound correspondent, who I asked to speak to the issue of the dog racing tracks closing in the way the coronavirus crisis has closed down so many businesses, especially where the public gathers. But the timing of this closure brings us close to when the tracks are required to close permanently under the tenets of Amendment 13. So we talk about what this might mean for the tracks, the dogs, possible adoptions of those former racing greyhounds, and more. Right now, though, we're going to step into the comedy corner. This is a piece by David Spade told on his terrific Comedy Central show, Lights Out, about a bird that he had to evict from his mansion. This is David Spade with a piece I'm calling Evicting a Bird in today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals on WMNF.
Okay, guys, I had a bit of a situation today. I had a bird fly into my house unannounced. I was home just relaxing. I had my door open, and I'm too chintzy for air conditioning or heat. There's been some belt tightening, and AC is the first to go. So while I'm relaxing, sometimes birds fly in my house, and at first I was scared because I didn't know what was going on. I thought it was a burglar. At first, I thought it was a burglar. It's not the best part, I hope. Because I don't know. They don't know what's going on. They don't do it on purpose, I don't think. I know you think, oh, you're famous. They want to come in and hang out. But I don't think that's it. I think they're just, it's randomly that it's open. But he's flying all over, and it's hard to keep track of him because my house is so big. You know. And I'm only adding that because it helps the story. So he sees the windows, and they're huge because it's a mansion, as discussed. So it's all a window, and then the ocean. So if you can tell he wants to fly to the ocean, but he doesn't know about the window. So, and I see this coming, I'm like, no, bird, don't do wind. And, of course, tweet, tweet, good douche. And then, but he was alive, okay? He goes in, and it's hard to watch. And he's a little bird, and I know he's a sparrow, and they're a dime a dozen, but I care, because It's an animal, and I love animals. And then he was rocked. Obviously, he got up and he was like, and he saw me, and he was more embarrassed than anything, I think, because he was like, and then he's ruffled, but then he's like, mung, 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 you know, birds are, and he's like, and he doesn't even know where he's going. He's like, I wanted to go there for something, but he couldn't, you know, remember. He was discombob for sure. Easily CTE at minimum. You know what I mean? Like, we didn't have to wait 20 years for the testing. This is live CTE on the spot. So I want him to go back out to nature. Great guy syndrome. So I go over to the Arcadia door to open it. Of course, it's like 12 feet high, unusually high. You know, it's a mansion. So I'm like, and it's all lats. And I open it just a little bit. But then I go over and stand behind him smartly because it's a trick. You know, he's a bird. Of course, I'm going to win this one. You know, so I look at him and he goes. And then I go, yes, keep going. Easily manipulated. So boing, boing, he's away from me. And then he gets all the way. Then I go over here and then I get him right to the part in the door, you know, where he's supposed to go out. And he sees it. But of course, he's scared because he obviously just hugely before. So he's like, yes, he's like. He tries to pack it, just make sure there's no window there. Then he takes his little forked foot. You know, pokes it out. Nothing, nothing, nothing. And then he's like, and he gets out, and he's like, ah. Wings a little rusty. Then he's like, later. Flies off. And then I feel like an asshole because I'm like, oh, hey, no tearful goodbye, guy. You know, like, I saved your life. I guess this is it for us, you know? Hero's a strong word, but whatever. Cool, dude. Have fun in Century City. Could be living a life in BH, but yeah, whatever. So I guess I'm an empty nester now.
All right. That was David Spade with a piece I've been calling Evicting a Bird, taken from his Comedy Central show Lights Out. Now it's time to hear my conversation with our Greyhound correspondent Don Goldstein about how the coronavirus has forced the Florida dog racing tracks to temporarily close down mere months before they'd be required to shut down permanently per the law under Amendment 13. Recorded on Saturday, this is Don Goldstein back on Talking Animals on WMNF.
So let's welcome back to the show, Don Goldstein. Thanks for joining us again on Talking Animals, Don.
Thanks for having me, Duncan, as always.
So let's jump right in. So recount for us, if you will, under the tenets of Amendment 13, what was the timetable where tracks that were still operating to whatever degree were going to be closed once and for all, and that was the end of it?
Well, Amendment 13 requires that all tracks cease operations after December 31st of this year, so basically effective January 1.
Yeah.
Many had already closed. We went into the election with 11 prior to the most recent issues. We had 6 that were still operating.
And when you say the current issues, like the coronavirus issues, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
To the best of my knowledge, there is currently only one track operating, and that's just from their website. They may not even be operating either. We're just not updating their website. I'm really not sure, and that's Naples.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine that whatever the website might suggest, that any track would be operating, just because it seems like legally, ethically, whatever way you want to look at it, that any time anybody would be gathering at some place like that, you'd be putting many people, including yourself, at risk.
My only thought is that they may be doing it strictly for simulcast. I don't know if they are, in fact, operating. All the others have identified on their website and every other way that they are, at least for the foreseeable future, not operating.
So, with that in mind, and with it being uncertain when any of these businesses, not just tracks, but any business at all, really, would be in a position to reopen, we're sort of then, I guess, before too long, we're brushing up against that December 31st cutoff date. So what does that mean? What are the implications for there maybe being a tiny slice of time, if that, between when everybody gets the all clear on the coronavirus signal and when the tracks need to be closed? I mean, do you suspect at this point the tracks will just say, all right, well, I don't know why we're even keeping anything afloat here. Should we just call it a day?
Well, of the six tracks that we're operating, three have said we're done.
Okay.
With the coronavirus closing, they've said, I don't care what happens, we're not coming back.
Okay.
Daytona was going to close in March anyway, or June, or April, I don't remember. Tampa, Orlando was going to close in June. They said, we're done. We're not closing. So we're not sure about Orange Park. There's been some rumors that they may not reopen. Palm Beach is saying they will reopen if allowed, and so is Derby Lane. But we don't know about them, and of course I already talked about Naples. So at most we're going to have three tracks operating for some period of time as we approach December 31st.
Okay. So that may or may not happen, but meanwhile, the three that said, hey, we're out in an accelerated timetable, what kind of implications are there for the dogs that were at those tracks? Just because I would think there would have been a certain sort of schedule and timetable in mind for when they expected to close and what would happen then to those dogs versus the coronavirus shutting it down kind of abruptly in at least three of those tracks, as you've outlined, saying, hey, we're not coming back regardless.
Well, as we've been saying for a long time, there are adoption groups all over the country that are waiting with bated breath to adopt these dogs. There's been some indication that a lot of the dogs will go out of Florida for a lot of different reasons, but we think most of them will go out of Florida. Some will stay here, but they will only go to adoption groups that have been approved by the NGA, the National Greyhound Association, which is the racing association.
I see. So even as this signals the end of racing in Florida, the racing association still has a tremendous say.
Well, I mean, that still leaves legally racing in five other states.
Right.
As far as I could tell, they're all closed because of coronavirus. Texas wouldn't be running right now anyway. They normally only operate from November to February. All the others are not functioning because of coronavirus. So whether they come back or not, I assume they will. They don't have any prohibition on it. But we'll have to see.
Yeah.
And some of the dogs, will, of course, some of the better racing dogs, as these tracks close in Florida, they will move to other tracks in the north. If they're winners, why not keep them winning?
You know? Oh, okay. So for anybody who might have been optimistic thinking, hey, when the tracks close, those dogs get to find homes, not so fast necessarily.
Well, yeah. And the industry is saying that they will have about 1,500 dogs available at some point, up to about 1,500 dogs. That's not an unreasonable figure, but again, a good share of those will go up north. Whether they're going to other tracks or into adoption groups, there are some approved adoption groups here in the state of Florida, not that many, frankly.
Yeah.
There was a pretty strict guidelines on who could be approved by NGA.
Wow.
My association does not make the list, by the way.
Huh. So for people that are thinking, hey, there's going to be dogs, well, some percentage of those dogs are going to be available sooner than people might have planned for or thought. Are there steps people could take if they're saying, hey, we've already adopted greyhounds in the past and we like them, or thinking about adopting more or coming back to that? Where should they look, either online or otherwise, for trying to focus their efforts?
If they want to go to an approved adoption group, they can go to the National Greyhound Association's website, and there is a tab for adopt, and it does list all of the approved adoption groups by state. I think there's 108 total, or 102. So they can do that. But I will warn people that just because of coronavirus, we're not doing anything. You know, I've got about five pending applications right now that I can't go do home visits for because we're locked in.
Oh, I see. So the adoption process itself is on hold in many places then for the same reasons.
Yes. The only exception we would make to that is somebody that has adopted from us before and is in the same house now. And a lot of the groups use the same kind of criteria. But a new adopter, almost everybody that I know of has a home visit as part of the process.
Right.
And of course, we can't do that now.
Yeah, no, that's an interesting wrinkle. Again, there's so many aspects. We were talking a little bit off air a moment ago about the coronavirus that you just, there's so many things to think about and factor in, and so many people are affected by this in sort of big, broad, dramatic ways that sometimes the smaller things that aren't small if you're a dog hoping to be adopted, I guess, but the idea that that's on hold right now too because we can't inspect the home and we can't see if we can complete the adoption. So,
right.
Yeah, that's a tough. So those dogs that are sort of otherwise would be available and just are kind of in a holding pattern, or how does that actually work until, again, the coronavirus limitations are lifted?
Yeah, they're going to be just in a holding pattern. I have no reason to think that the trainers and breeders won't hang on to them until somebody can. I mean, many of the groups are like my group that only uses foster homes. We don't have a kennel facility. Some do, but several of those have dropped off the boards, too. So I think that the dogs are just going to be in a holding pattern. The good news is that most of these breeders and trainers, they had a further date in mind anyway. So it's not like they're having to keep them beyond what they thought they would.
Right. It's the opposite, really. And it's,
exactly.
Yeah. So nobody's going to be...
I have every expectation, Duncan, that the dogs are safe for the foreseeable future.
Right. So everything's fine, if we have a pretty loose definition, fine. But it, again, sounds like from your standpoint, it will work out once, again, the virus is no longer such an issue as to block various things, including home inspections and other things that are part of the adoption process.
Yes, I honestly think that's going to be the case.
Okay. All right. Well, so that's going to leave it, I think, on an optimistic note. So anything else we should know before we wrap up this conversation today, Don?
No, Duncan, but I appreciate over the last several years all of your support for not only greyhounds, which, of course, are my love, but for all animals. You know, I listen to your program regularly, and thank
you're,
you
you're
so
the
much
guy
for what you do.
I was trying to identify which person that was, so it's good to finally know. So thank you, Don. No, but I appreciate those nice words. That's really fine. Yeah, I mean, I always had a soft spot for the whole greyhound issue, and so just want to carry this through as the tracks close and hopefully the dogs go to some good homes. So it sounds like that's likely to happen in many cases. It's just going to have to hang tight, like everything is sort of hanging tight until the virus situation clears up.
We think so.
Yeah. All right, Don. Well, thank you again for joining us on Talking Animals and offering your great expertise. We appreciate it, as we have over many, many years.
Thank you, Duncan.
After we recorded the interview, Don wanted to be sure to give the website for the National Greyhound Association. That is ngagreyhoundsplural.com. So ngagreyhounds.com, which, as he mentioned, offers state-by-state adoption information. Coming up at 11 on WMNF, it's Rob Lori with Radioactivity. Meanwhile, on today's show is the prize for Name That Animal Tune. I'll be offering a Talking Animals t-shirt. And we'll be doing it a little differently today. Rather than call if you know the tune, please email me at Duncan@WMNF.org with your guest. So I'm Duncan Strauss. You are listening to Talking Animals, where the show website is talkinganimals.net. It is time to dive into Name That Animal Tune. There'll be a prize, that Talking Animals t-shirt, to the first person who emails Duncan@WMNF.org, correctly identifying this animal song. With a nod to the hottest show on Netflix at the moment, it's Name That Animal Tune on Talking Animals on WMNF.
I've got a tiger by the tail, it's plain to see. I won't be much when you get through with me. Well, I'm losing weight and I'm turning mighty pale. Looks like I've got a tiger by the tail. Well, I thought the day I met you, you were meek as a lamb, just the kind to fit my dreams and plans.
Can you name that animal too? And again, just email us at Duncan@WMNF.org. The first person that does so gets the Talking Animals t-shirt. So I think we have time to squeeze in an animal song, in this case by an animal band of sorts, one of our faves here. It's I Like Birds from the Eels on Talking Animals on WMNF.
I can't look at the rocket launch, trophy wives of the astronauts, and I won't listen to their words, 'cause I like birds. I don't care for walking downtown, crazy auto car gonna mow me down, look at all the people like cows in a herd. Well, I like birds. If you're small and on a
dogs.
About reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa. My huge thanks to Lee Courtney. Flea, thank you, Flea. And for all the in-studio help and other production assistance this morning making this thing happen from 200 miles apart. Not bad. Thank you so much. Next Wednesday, assuming we're still producing a modified version of Talking Animals in the same manner, I invite you to return when my guest will be Susan Fleming, the filmmaker who directed the new documentary Remarkable Rabbits, which will premiere that night on the PBS series Nature. Something cool to watch while on lockdown. Also invited to visit TalkingAnimals.net for audio archives of every show we've ever broadcast. iTunes podcasts are available there too. There are also links to our Facebook page, our Instagram page, our Twitter feed, and more. Plus, like us on Facebook, the show and or me personally, follow me on Twitter and Instagram. The whole shebang. You can also subscribe to our newsletter to find out about our guests a couple of days beforehand and other news from the Talking Animals world. That's all found at TalkingAnimals.net. I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. This is Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa, Brandon, Clearwater, Largo, Weekiwachi, and beyond. Stay safe. Stay healthy. Thanks again, Flea. We'll see you next Wednesday morning.